longing. The magnificent arched windows of Hogwarts were smitten gold in the early sunset of a Scottish winter, their panes glowing like heated metal, and the air was crisp and clear. It was a romantic backdrop for a pretty girl, especially one as fetchingly turned out as Cosmina was, in a chocolate brown and bronze beaded capelet, tied gracefully around her slender neck with a velvet grosgrain ribbon. "I don't know what was wrong with me this morning," Neville mused as they strolled hand in hand towards Greenhouse One. "I think Rosie made me mental or something. Cosmina's great, and with my luck, I'll never get a chance with someone like her again. I'm not letting some muggle bitch from hell ruin my life. I'm never going to think about her again. Never. Never, ever, ever." They stepped into the welcoming warmth of the classroom, and Neville trailed behind Cosmina with an impressed expression as she effortlessly reeled off the names, elements, and magical effects of each plant perused.
"I can't believe you know so much about plants," he said admiringly.
"They're fascinating to me," she replied happily and stole a coquettish glance up at him. "But I am not as attracted with them as I am of you."
Neville beamed at this grammatically incorrect proclamation.
"Most men, they are only after the one thing," Cosmina declared with a pretty pout. "They will use you, and everything is the big game to them. You are nothing like that," she added decisively.
"No," Neville blurted out in a horrified voice. "I'll never use you, and I'm going to get you a ring," he pronounced determinedly, "so everyone will know you're my girlfriend."
Cosmina threw her arms around his neck, and they exchanged a long, hot kiss.
"I did not think this would ever happen to me," she said unsteadily when they broke apart. "That I would, well,"
she dropped her gaze shyly to the floor,
"meet you,"
she finished quickly. What she meant to say was fall in love with you, Neville thought ecstatically. "I can't believe it. Somebody's actually in love with me. And not just anybody. A totally gorgeous woman who's intelligent and sweet and somewhat important. What do I care if she's into her career? I should be proud of her. At least she's got a real career at the ministry, not some career jumping around in her underwear like some slag on Nocturne Alley. Not that I care, because I'm not thinking about her anymore. I'm not thinking about anybody except Cosmina! Cosmina!" Cosmina gave him a bewildered look, apparently hurt by his lack of response, and Neville closed his eyes angrily and told himself to concentrate. "I'm going to lose her if I don't straighten up. How am I going to get that person out of my stupid head?" "By spending more time with Cosmina, that's how," he decided resolutely. "The more time I spend with her, the less I'll waste thinking about that person. And it'll be brilliant. We'll talk about defense and plants and shag all the time. And I'll never be lonely again."
"Cosmina," he said impulsively, "you probably think I'm crazy for saying this, but..."
"Is that your owl?"
Cosmina broke in worriedly and pointed a gloved finger outside, where a large brown owl was flying wildly towards the speckled yellow windows.
"Slow down!" Neville bellowed and waved his arms violently. "Don't try to fly through the..."
The owl crashed through the greenhouse windows, showering both of them with shards of glass and ushering in a gust of arctic wind.
"Window," Neville finished lamely. "Are you okay?"
"I am fine,"
Cosmina replied breathlessly.
"I am fine."
"He's the worst owl anybody's ever had," Neville yelled hotly. "He's flown through these windows a million times. Reparo! That's why I call him Icarus," he said nastily and glared at the bird, who was hopping about on the countertop, hooting shrilly. "I'm hoping he'll fly too close to the sun."
Icarus promptly stretched out his beak and bit him on the finger.
"Ow!" Neville hollered wrathfully. "Stop that!"
Icarus hooted furiously and began swooping feverishly about the room, and Cosmina looked at Neville and smiled.
"Do not worry about this owl,"
she told him firmly.
"You were saying something. Something important."
"I was," Neville rejoined vehemently. "I was going to say something important. I was going to ask you to marry me. And then that stupid bird ruined it all by..."
Icarus let out an enormous screech and cut loose a large splattering of owl droppings directly onto Neville's head, and Cosmina burst into a gale of laughter.
"I am sorry," she giggled. "It's just, you have the worst luck that there is. And I would love to marry you,"
she enthused, her eyes shining.
"Even with those owl shit things on your hair."
Neville started smiling.
"Is this not the right word?"
Cosmina asked him coyly. It's so great to always be one who knows, Neville thought happily.
"Well, not exactly, but do you mean it? You'll marry me?"
"I would be honored,"
she replied sweetly.
"I cannot believe you would ask this of me. You are the best person I have ever known.
Suddenly her face fell.
Your friends will not like it,
she said unhappily.
They will tell you we have just known each other a short while. They will tell you not to do it.
No, they won't, Neville responded stubbornly. It's my own business. I can make up my own mind.
That Remus Lupin, he will tell you not to do it,
Cosmina wailed.
And you will listen to him because you think very well of him. I know this. I knew this was all too good to be true.
Neville briefly pictured himself sitting sullenly on the couch while Lupin paced around his living room, pleading with him to just wait a few months and think this over.
Yeah, he'll talk me out of it, Neville responded glumly. Well, no, he will.
Cosmina burst into tears.
But he's not getting the chance, he hollered out defiantly. We'll go to the ministry and get married right now. Then it'll be too late for anybody to say anything.
Cosmina blew her nose into her handkerchief and peered up at him hopefully.
Yeah, that's exactly what we're going to do, he reiterated determinedly. We'll go right now while they're still open.
As soon as these words were out of his mouth, a small voice of logic began an impassioned plea from the back of his brain.
Wait, hang on, think about this for a minute. Don't just run out and...
Cosmina leaned against him and pressed her breasts into his chest, her breath warm and sweet in his ear.
Tonight, I will not be so shy,
she whispered meaningfully.
Since we will be husband and wife, tonight will be even better.
Neville snatched up his top hat and cloak. Solange stood in front of the bathroom mirror, yawning as she towel-dried her hair and twisted it into a tortoiseshell claw. For a few moments, she pondered the rather serious issue of what to do about the husband she might or might not be in love with, and then decided in her usual impetuous fashion to just wait and see what happened. When she strolled out of the bathroom, she discovered Lucretia, clad in possibly the world's largest pair of pantyhose, sitting cross-legged on her bed, hollering into a telephone.
Put them on that plane, quick! She bellowed without looking up. I done told you, Mr. Quiller might change his mind. No, ma'am, I don't care what she say. You tell Moses to get himself over here and pick her old bony ass up and put her in that taxi. What? I know it's cotton crazy. Mr. Quiller don't know that he...
She glanced up at Solange and hastily slammed down the receiver.
Well, I don't care,
Solange told her cheerfully as she rummaged through her suitcase.
They might as well get settled in while we're away.
That's what I thought, too,
Lucretia beamed as she waddled enthusiastically over to the tall, arched windows.
Look at that. You can see them city walls from here.
Rothenburg's the only medieval city in Europe that still has its entire original walls,
Solange squealed, and Lucretia let out a satisfying gasp.
You can't drive a car inside because they keep everything in period. They call it the most medieval village in Europe.
Ooh-wee! Lucretia shrieked ecstatically. This is going to be one great day, Miss Solange. I can't wait to see this medieval town. We got to go eat first, though,
she nodded vociferously.
I'm hungry as a mama bear with 12 babies hanging on her titties. Yes, I is.
When they entered the dining room, Solange discovered Quentin already seated at a table, wearing the despised salmon-colored shirt and a white silk scarf, and gave him an appreciative smile.
You look very handsome,
she whispered, and looked directly into his eyes. Quentin felt a sudden rush of heat and energy between them, and shifted in his chair.
If you like, you could put some gel in my hair before we go out,
he responded unsteadily, and Solange gazed back at him in an unmistakably libidinous manner as her pink lips parted slightly.
Well,
she whispered breathlessly and leaned towards him,
I think I should.
We ain't got time for that, Lucretia broke in impatiently. Mr. Quiller looking just fine the way he is. I wants to get going.
Quentin fixed her with a positively murderous expression, and Solange put a consoling hand on his arm.
Rothenburg is the city of eternal Christmas,
she gushed excitedly.
There's a wonderful Christmas village and market and the most beautiful tree, and they keep it up all year long. Oh, I hope it snows,
she finished with a squeal and clapped her hands. Who gives a fuck, Quentin thought, but refrained from saying this out loud.
Of course it'll snow, he muttered with another particularly nasty look at Lucretia. Don't worry about it.
When they left the inn, however, the sun was shining, and the temperature was an unseasonably warm 50 degrees, and Solange began frowning.
We're in Germany and it's January,
she screeched.
Why is it so warm?
Is that glowly warning?
Lucretia said knowingly.
Mm-hmm, that's exactly what it is. Every year getting hotter and hotter.
"Because the end times is coming," she proclaimed ominously. Neither Quentin nor Solange appeared especially worried about this. "We'll go shopping," Quentin told Solange firmly. "A cold front will probably blow in this afternoon." Solange did not seem convinced, however, and after exiting each store, she gazed angrily upwards, apparently incensed by the puffy white clouds floating dreamily across the beautiful azure sky. "She is so fucking spoiled," Quentin thought crossly when they stopped at a quaint little cafe for lunch, and Solange plopped her dozen bags of purchases on the wooden floor with a petulant expression.
"I'll have the kartoffel salad,"
she informed the waiter irritably, and Quentin shot her a disgusted look as he politely requested Hassan Pfeffer.
"Kartoff salad," Lucretia informed them loudly. "Be a potato salad that made with a real creamy mayonnaise dressing on meat broth. And that hass and pfeffer, that'd be stew from a rabbit."
"Oh, quit being such a show-off,"
Solange demanded.
"We didn't need to hear the whole recipe for everything we eat."
Lucretia did not even glance at Solange from behind her menu.
"I'm having this lobscouse," she continued in an authoritative tone. "Mm-hmm. That a one-dish meal made with mashed taters, corned beef, and beets, Miss Solange, in case you wants to know. You serves it with a fried egg and pickled herring and a pickled cucumber. I figure I better eat some pickles here, because they sure ain't none at home," she grumbled darkly, "since all of them pickles done sploded onto Mr. Neville when their pantry blowed up."
"What?" Quentin shouted.
"The pantry blew up."
"I tells you later," Lucretia responded hastily.
"I gots to go to the bathroom. My guts all in a knot and I don't want to pass no gas here at this table."
Quentin did not question her any further. After exiting the cafe, Solange glared up at the sky again and stridently announced that it might as well be a summer day at the beach, and Lucretia narrowed her eyes and frowned at her.
"You quit there complaining," she harumphed. "We tired of it and it just going to get you more riled up. That's what Miss Elizabeth would tell you. You needs to be more sensible like her."
Solange huffed and folded her arms across her bosom.
"I don't care what Elizabeth would say," she sniffed petulantly. "And I know you always liked her better than me."
"Good God," Quentin thought incredulously. "Is she 12 years old?"
"Well," Lucretia responded threateningly and screeched to a halt. "Who'll come and spend time with me in the kitchen? Miss Elizabeth, that who? And who else was off with her silly friends or calling boys all the time? Didn't pay me no mind at all?"
"Elizabeth was boring,"
Solange responded churlishly.
"Maybe I had better things to do than sit around with the cook all day."
Lucretia was so infuriated by this remark, she turned completely away from Solange and addressed Quentin instead.
"This is exactly why Miss Caroline couldn't keep no governess," she hissed furiously. "Because Miss Solange was so spoiled, and Miss Loretta never stopped that damn whining."
"No doubt," Quentin thought sourly.
"Oh, look over there, Miss Sequilla,"
Lucretia shrieked suddenly and tugged excitedly on his sleeve.
"A real awesome buggy ride. I wants to ride in that awesome buggy."
She pointed excitedly towards a tiny silk carriage, driven by a diminutive Asian driver in gaudy gold and orange braided livery.
"Yo-ho-ho!" Lucretia screeched and waved wildly at the man. "Hey, you Chinaman over there! We wants to ride in that buggy!"
The driver glanced up and immediately put on an obsequious smile when he noted Quentin's impeccably tailored black wool coat and Solange's rose-colored mink jacket, ropes of glistening pearls, and sequin Prada handbag.
"I is at your service,"
he shouted enthusiastically as he pulled the carriage up beside them.
"You come in my carriage. Have super time. Car, my whole town, only 50 euro. Super bargain, super bargain. 50 more, you're off a big lady," he added tactlessly. "Big lady straight hard on horses."
Lucretia did not appear at all offended by this remark, as she hastily clambered into the back of the carriage, only to have her mammoth behind wedge itself tightly in the doorway.
"I can't get in here," she bellowed wrathfully. "This carriage made for you little tiny Chinese peoples. You Chinese people stunning up or something?"
Quentin thought the driver took an inordinate pleasure in giving Lucretia's ass a great shove.
"Now you in the carriage,"
he pronounced happily, as Lucretia sprawled out on the seat with a loud, "Oh,
very good, very good."
He proffered a gloved hand to Solange, who smiled at him sweetly as she sat next to Lucretia. "Well, at least we'll be squashed in here together," she thought with satisfaction, and glanced expectantly at Quentin. "Then I can flirt with him. He is being awfully sweet." "You two go on," Quentin told them generously. "I'll have a coffee in the cafe and watch the packages. There isn't enough room in there for me." Solange glared at him and slammed the carriage door shut, and Quentin, who had imagined she would be pleased with his concern for her comfort, decided he had definitely married the most unreasonable woman on earth.
You go real fast, Lucretia enthused as they took off with a jolt. The faster you go is the bigger tip I tell Mr. Quill to give you.
I go fast, super fast, the man declared happily and cracked his whip. You never see a horse that go so fast.
The horses thundered across the cobblestone street, careening around a group of package-laden pedestrians, and the carriage tilted alarmingly to one side.
Slow down, Slosh shrieked, and loosen up those reins. Those horses are going to bolt.
You're not talking about my horses, the driver shouted back angrily.
This is my buggy! These are my horses!
Oh!
Slosh squealed as the carriage zoomed recklessly across the broad market square and headed towards the city gates.
I know how to ride! I've been riding my whole life! And I'm telling you!
On cue, all six horses bolted at once.
Now look what you do! The man yelled frantically and tugged on the reins.
You got horses all upset!
This all your fault!
He proclaimed accusingly.
Oh, Lord! Lucretia howled as the horses tore off at a dead run. We're going to die! That China man, he's going to kill us!
The driver helpfully dropped the reins and threw his arms over his eyes, apparently unwilling to witness his own demise.
This is all your fault! Slosh screeched at Lucretia. You're the one that told him to go faster!
You watch your mouth, missy!
Lucretia thundered back in response.
I'm getting out of here!
She leaned over Solange and lunged unsuccessfully for the door handle, a futile attempt which only left her wedged between Solange and the front seat.
I can't even move back here, Lucretia bellowed furiously. It goes, Miss Solange got some big old butt!
Ow! Ow!
Solange screeched wildly and pinched Lucretia's arm, and the buggy flipped over with a resounding crash. Quentin was not the slightest bit surprised when Solange and Lucretia burst through the doorway of the cafe, both shrieking at the top of their lungs. Solange's mink was torn off her shoulder, and black stripes of axle grease smeared her pink satin blouse, while Lucretia sported an angry red bruise on her arm, a gash above each eyebrow, and what appeared to be a large black hoof print tattooed across her left cheek. Oh, for fuck's sake, Quentin thought wearily.
Miss Solange pinched my arm, Lucretia shrilled out wrathfully. She done attacked me, Miss Aquila. That exactly what she done.
Lucretia turned the whole buggy over, Solange declared spitefully, because she's so fat.
Solange, Quentin barked out incredulously. Quit being so damn rude.
Fine then, take her side, Solange hollered back. You two can spend the whole day together. I'm going to have some snow, she declared obstinately. Elizabeth said when they got married it was warm because that old Grandpa John can change the weather.
She turned and stomped defiantly out the door.
Solange! Quentin shouted ineffectually and threw down his paper. Huh! Lucretia grumbled dourly as she trailed him to the doorway. You just wait and see, Mr. Quilla. Ain't no telling what you're going to be doing.
Quentin discovered Solange standing outside on the sidewalk, screaming up at the sky, apparently oblivious to the furiously giggling crowd surrounding her.
John Lupin!
She shrilled as Lucretia let out a great snort of disgust.
John Lupin! I need you here! I need you here now!
She the most embarrassing person in the whole world, Lucretia told Quentin vehemently. She just holler out anything!
A huge cloud of dazzling orange smoke exploded across the market square with an earth-shaking boom, trailing off to reveal John Lupin in a pink silk turban and flaming fuchsia robes, a dozen different timepieces hanging from chains around his neck.
Help!
He hollered and pointed his wand suspiciously at the hastily dispersing crowd.
Distress call! Who's after you?
He called happily over to Solange.
Why, I'll take care of this business. I was an oral, you know.
No one's after her, Quentin told him disgustedly. She's fine. And you've no need to put on some great bloody show. Remus says you do that cloud shit just for effect.
John looked straight through Quentin in such a disconcerting fashion, he actually glanced down to see if he was still visible.
I summoned you,
Solange chirped out happily.
We're visiting this magical Christmas village, but it's warm here. We really need some snow tonight,
she beamed.
Snow?
John bellowed back incredulously.
Snow? You have summoned me here for a climate change!
You ain't supposed to summon someone's lessing you life in danger,
Lucretia intoned self-righteously.
No, ma'am, you don't. Don't you know nothing about wizards?
Apparently she does not, John barked back. I'll have you know, I was giving a talk at the most mystical and magnificently magical International Scientific Wizarding Convention on Time Theory. 1,600 wizards were hanging on my every word, I tell you. I had them in the palm of my hand. They were mesmerized, enthralled, spellbound, enchanted, captivated,
he shrieked.
I was relating to them how Bogus Tiddlesworth and I invented the time turner. Some old time turner isn't going to get us any snow,
Solange replied impatiently.
That's what you're here for, to make us some snow.
She the rudest white girl I ever met, Lucretia whispered to John. I says you make it a hot summer day. Yes, sir, that's sure her, summoning you for that big meeting where you speaking and all.
A distinctly evil smile crept stealthily across John's face.
A sultry summer day,
he pronounced exultantly.
Yes, I believe that's the ticket. Humid, sizzling, scorching, stifling.
He promptly disappeared in a tornado of violent purple smoke, and Lucretia pulled out a handkerchief and began mopping sweat off her face.
Good Lord, she bawled out. I didn't want him to make it this hot. I bet it's 90 degrees out here. This was the summertime in Alabama.
"'Dis all you fault, missy,'
she hissed threateningly at Solange, who was glaring at the spot where John had stood.
"'Oh, I just want to go home,'
Solange shouted.
"'Least it's air-conditioned in the car, and you told him to do it!'
she screeched as Lucretia let out an unrepentant sniff.
"'Lucretia ruins everything,'
she added irritably to Quentin.
"'What?' he shouted. "'Don't be blaming Lucretia when it was your own fucking fault, "'and I'll be happy to take your ungrateful ass home. "'Perhaps Lucretia and I will come back without you,'
he added nastily.
"'Mr. Quilla like gone place it with me,'
Lucretia announced happily "'and smiled very smugly at Solange.
"'Yes'm, he sure do, because I'm so easy to get along with.'
"'Solange took off her shoe and threw it at Lucretia.' Kill all my demons, and my angels might just die too. Tennessee Williams. This is not possible, Radu thought furiously as he stared angrily down at the filthy stone floor beneath his boots. He dares to say he loathes and despises me, after all I've done for him? Since Radu was completely incapable of finding fault with himself, he had already forgotten it was he who had made this statement first. An inexplicable mixture of rage and misery broke out inside his chest, settling into a fierce ache of emotion he could neither define nor comprehend. After an eternity of silence, Lupin, who always felt ashamed and rather sick after losing his temper, spoke out into the darkness.
"Look," he said pensively, "I'm sorry about this whole business. I shouldn't have lost my temper, and I shouldn't have gotten us locked up down here."
Radu was far more affected by the fact that Lupin had spoken these words in English than the actual message, perceiving the use of his cellmate's native language as an offering of increased familiarity, an accurate insight of which Lupin himself was not entirely aware. "This is his language," Radu thought in a bemused fashion, "and that is his natural accent and inflection." In much the same manner as Lupin was affected by scent, Radu was influenced by sound. A voice was as displeasing or arousing to him as a face or body, and the sentences spoken reverberated through his head in a strangely intoxicating fashion.
"No," he replied haughtily after some time had passed. "You should not have done either of these things. You have treated me quite badly."
He turned rudely away towards the wall so that only his slim, stubborn shoulders and long black hair were visible, and Lupin was briefly reminded of Elizabeth, which only made him feel worse.
"I really am sorry," he told Radu forlornly,
and Radu closed his eyes and waved his hand angrily. "This is impossible," he thought bitterly. "He has mocked me and humiliated me and locked me up in my own dungeons, and still I..." He could not finish the sentence, even in his own mind.
"I shall allow it,"
he declared resentfully after several minutes had passed, and Lupin sighed and decided reparations were definitely in order.
"That's awfully good of you,"
he said solemnly and flashed Radu an engaging smile.
"It's fortunate for me that you're inclined to be gracious today."
Radu frowned horribly at this.
"Do not attempt to win my affections," he spat out harshly. "I do not find you nearly so charming as you believe that I do." "I didn't know you found me charming at all,"
Lupin responded cheerfully.
"Thank you."
He was rather startled when a genuine smile, one without a trace of artifice or arrogance, appeared on Radu's face, something which transformed his countenance rather remarkably.
"I do not know what I shall do with you,"
his cellmate replied crossly.
"I am quite certain you would be the death of me."
Lupin ignored this dire prediction and put his boots up on the rickety little chair with the broken leg.
"You're small more often,"
he told Radu amiably.
"Reparo. You're not a bad-looking fellow, you know. I find little to smile about,"
he responded sourly.
"However, I am flattered that you find me so attractive.
Lupin broke out laughing.
I don't believe I said I found you attractive,
he said genially.
Let's have some of this Transylvanian fire whiskey you've been boasting about.
Radu snapped his fingers, and a square tea table draped with folds of crimson and gold brocade fabric promptly appeared, accompanied by two balloon-backed velvet armchairs. And after perusing this with a self-satisfied expression, he gestured for Lupin to take a seat. Moments later, a pair of cloisonné sheen-cut crystal goblets and a perfectly round bottle of bubbling orange liquid materialized atop the table as well. When Lupin saw the fire whiskey, he remembered Elizabeth delightedly yelling, "It was orange!" at the breakfast table during their mischief break, and started smiling in the same besotted manner which his great-great-grandfather had declared made him want to vomit up his turkey. Radu, unsurprisingly, instantly surmised this expression was due to Lupin's sudden awareness of his irresistible charm. "It's quite apparent that he's bisexual," he told himself decisively. "Of course he has repressed these feelings for years. Perhaps he does not even recognize them. It is obvious to me, however. Clearly he is drawn to me against his will." This might have seemed an incredible amount of self-delusion for a man of Radu's age, intelligence, and powers of observation. But in truth, Lupin actually was drawn to him against his will, albeit not in the manner Radu enjoyed imagining. After allowing sufficient time for the admiration of his chairs and table, Radu pointed a slender finger towards the ceiling and watched with a slight smile as scores of pale, tapered candles materialized in silence, followed by two ornately gilded mirrors which hung at opposite ends of the cell.
"This is excellent," Lupin told him sincerely. "You'll have to show me how to do this. My wife would love it."
"And you must ruin everything," Radu thought angrily.
"Light up the candles," he demanded.
When the candles burst into flame, the infinitesimal number of flickering golden lights from reflecting mirrors transformed the little space into a dazzling canopy of radiant, romantic glow.
"You've actually made this place rather charming,"
Lupin told him with an impressed air.
"I like this tablecloth,"
he added thoughtfully as he fingered the embroidered red and gold silk material.
"Gryffindor colors."
"As are the colors of my couch,"
Radu drawled out languidly and handed him a goblet of fire whiskey.
"Which I would be pleased to enlarge. Drink."
Lupin found the remark about the couch sufficiently disturbing to gulp down the entire goblet in one draught.
"It's rather strong,"
he coughed.
"Very good, though."
The fire whiskey, after blistering through his veins like molten lava, melted into a sensation of satiated warmth and a fierce sort of bliss, and after a few moments he looked over at Radu with a cheerful and positively affectionate expression.
"What are you thinking about?"
he asked him lazily. "I'm thinking of your lips and your eyes and your hair, my friend. I'm thinking of you angry and disheveled and dangerous, forcing me to my knees and demanding I pleasure you. Something you will find far more satisfying than any woman has ever accomplished."
"I am thinking of a ballad,"
he responded evenly.
"An old Ottoman ballad, written in Middle Turkish. This language you would not know."
Lupin was unsurprised when he offered up nothing further.
"Well, translate it for me then,"
he said with interest, and Radu favored him with a sly smile.
"But of course,"
he replied indolently,
"you shall like it. I dreamt that you bewitched me into your bed, and there you sang me love-struck, and kissed me quite insane."
"I do like it,"
Lupin said fervently, as a fantastic image of Elizabeth flashed before his eyes.
"I like it so well, I'll put it to memory."
"All poetry should be put to memory, if it is appreciated,"
Radu responded superciliously, although the coolness of his tone belied his emotions, which were very odd and impossible to label. Another person might have stated they felt excited, giddy, and nervous. But since none of these words had ever held any meaning to him, his confusion was understandable. Peculiar though they were, however, the presence of any emotion other than irritation, rage, boredom, or misery, his inseparable companions for 250 very long years, was an unspeakable relief. A relief, he thought, and an almost unbearable pleasure. Pulses of heat reverberated down his spine until the back of his neck was warm and damp. His breathing quickened, and a delicious ache that started in his groin seemed to burn straight through to the core of his being.
"Watch out!"
Lupin hissed suddenly and dove beneath the red velvet couch, emerging seconds later with an enormous black rat in hand.
"I thought you might want one,"
he offered up cheerfully and tossed it to Radu.
"You know, for the blood."
"Oh, that was very kind of you,"
his companion enthused and immediately bit into the squealing rodent.
"They are difficult to catch. This does not offend you.
He paused to wipe his mouth with the corner of an embroidered linen serviette.
No,
Lupin replied in a surprised voice.
I'm like a rat myself in its full moon. Even if I've had the Wolfsbane potion, I still want a rat. I keep them in the shack, see? Hide them from Neville. I don't want him to know.
He whispered, and glanced uneasily around the cell, as if Neville might spring forth from behind a couch at any moment.
You are continually speaking of this Neville,
Radu pronounced irritably as he finished off the rat.
I never cease to hear his name.
Right, he's great,
Lupin nodded enthusiastically, obviously missing the message entirely.
Did I tell you I showed him that defense game we made up? He loved it.
He said gleefully.
We played for 7 hours one night. When Elizabeth got up the next morning and saw us still sitting at that table, she was pissed as all bloody hell. You never saw Neville apparate out of anywhere so fast.
What?
Radu shouted wrathfully.
Why are you telling me this? This is our game. Why are you playing our game with another man?
Well, I didn't think you'd care.
Lupin replied in a bewildered voice as he finished off his third goblet of fire whiskey.
He liked it.
You shall never again play our game with this Neville,
Radu spat out vituperatively.
Okay,
Lupin responded obediently.
Am I allowed to play with anyone else?
Of course not, Radu snarled in an outraged tone. I cannot believe you would even ask this of me.
Lupin just shrugged and kept drinking his fire whiskey.
Whatever makes you happy,
he replied agreeably, and Radu frowned at him.
You are most friendly drunk,
he stated resentfully.
You are far too pleasant when you are sober. In this condition, you would certainly be taken advantage of.
True,
Lupin responded readily.
That's why I only drink with my friends.
This seemingly innocuous statement apparently infuriated Radu.
These humans you call your friends,
he hissed in response,
do nothing but abuse you, and you are far too naive to discern it. Do not interrupt!
He shouted angrily when Lupin opened his mouth.
This Albus Dumbledore, whom you admired so greatly, was well aware of the self-loathing you inflict upon yourself due to your lycanthropy. Yet he sent you to live amongst feral wolves. This man who knew you so intimately since you were a child. It is indisputable that he of all people would recognize the utter misery this would cause you.
Lupin put his goblet down and looked at the floor.
I don't know,
he said dejectedly.
He apologized to me afterwards. I wasn't angry with him, but... Well, I still don't know why he'd do it.
Radu sprang up from his chair and began pacing the stone floor.
I shall expose these humans to you if it is the last thing that I do,
he declared venomously.
And these are the ones you name your friends. I cannot imagine how your enemies treat you.
Well,
Lupin pondered this seriously.
They call me a bloodthirsty beast and say I shouldn't be allowed to live,
he added helpfully.
It doesn't bother me. I'm used to it.
You are not,
Radu stated flatly.
You are not and will never become accustomed to it. And it bothers you a great deal.
He sat back down on his sofa in a rigid fashion.
I suppose,
Lupin replied wearily.
It doesn't do any good to say so. Nobody likes a person who's always feeling sorry for themselves.
That is your great weakness, my friend,
Radu pronounced haughtily.
Your constant concern with the opinion of others. And did these friends of yours come to your defense when you were ordered to live with these wolves?
Lupin staggered over to the couch and sat down right next to Radu, apparently delighted with this unexpected show of sympathy.
No, they did not,
he said conspiratorially.
Shacklebolt told me to quit whining, and Mad-Eye shouted at me to do as I was told. And even Arthur said there's no need to carry him on about bunking down with some wolves. That's why I never told him about it afterwards,
he finished stubbornly.
Because I knew they wouldn't understand.
Radu mulled over his reply for several minutes, since Lupin's thigh was pressed up against his own, and he was so lightheaded the room was spinning.
And how could they understand you?
He finally responded in a scornful voice.
They do not even care enough to attempt it. However, I shall understand you. You may tell me about these wolves.
Lupin did not consider this directive for long.
It was a fucking nightmare,
he responded determinedly.
I could only take half that wolfsbane potion, you know. So I'd be enough like them not to arouse suspicion, but enough like myself so I wouldn't kill anyone. Only the longer I stayed there, the more like them I got. I know Severus kept watering it down,
he added angrily.
I'm telling you, I know it.
Undoubtedly he would have,
Radu responded coldly.
The pitiless manner in which these humans treat you is unfathomable. They would not dare to have done it if I had been present,
he declaimed arrogantly.
Well, it's too late now,
Lupin responded sulkily.
Anyway, when I was with those feral wolves.
Feral wolves, Radu interrupted courteously.
The plural of wolf being wolves.
We're speaking English here,
Lupin shouted in an exasperated tone.
English! And who's this person from England? I think it's me.
Radu smiled quite affectionately at him after this outburst.
Yes, you are certainly an Englishman,
he replied in an amused voice.
And therefore your opinion is far superior to that of all others. Dieu est mon droit?
No.
That is the Muggle national motto,
Lupin responded loftily.
Not ours.
You want to hear the story or not?
I am most anxious to hear the story,
Radu told him silkily.
And I would apologize for interrupting, but I am enjoying your inebriated impertinence. Please continue.
All right,
Lupin said magnanimously.
It was horrible. I had to stay under the ground,
he shuddered,
under the Muggle trains in London with the worst sort of illiterate, filthy bastards you can imagine. But that wasn't the worst part.
He paused and Radu gave him a sympathetic look.
And what was the worst part?
Well,
Lupin said warily,
one full moon, the Owl Wolves killed this woman when I was in the back messing around with this she-wolf. Her name was Lydia.
He added unnecessarily.
And when I ran up and saw what they'd done, you know what I thought?
He looked up at Radu as if to gauge his reaction. And when Radu merely gazed at him in a benevolent manner, his tone became much more cheerful.
I thought, I want some of that too. Before it was all gone, you know.
He continued enthusiastically.
I knocked all the other wolves out of the way and ate her whole left leg and her right boob. The other one was already gone.
He finished resentfully.
And why should you not?
Radu declared sharply.
This woman was already dead. Why should you not eat her?
What if Elizabeth knew?
Lupin responded in an utterly horrified voice.
She never let me near her again. Then I'd die. I'm telling you, I would die,
he pronounced wretchedly. Radu appeared unimpressed by this melodramatic statement.
This woman does not understand you,
he sighed in a positively delighted tone.
I'm quite sorry to hear it.
So won't you understand me,
Lupin replied despondently.
Anyway, next day when I realized what I'd done, I thought I'd kill myself. But I had my sword and I made a great cock-up of it. I tried to hang myself and a tree limb broke, and I threw myself in the Thames and the Egypt fished me out. So I thought, I've tossed myself up, but I couldn't concentrate and I ended up in this huge black cloud of smoke. The damn Muggle fire brigade showed up,
he intoned gloomily.
They had those god-awful horns.
Radu gave him a consoling look.
So I went back to Padfoot's,
he continued morosely.
But I wouldn't tell anyone what happened. Sirius kept following me around, shouting, "Damn it, Mooney! I don't give a fuck what you do when you're the wolf." But what does he know about it?
He did not know, Radu replied smoothly. Sirius Black was an animagus. That is quite a different thing from a werewolf.
Bloody well, right on that,
Lupin said crossly.
He turned into a damn dog. Everybody likes a dog,
he scowled.
People play with them.
Yes,
Radu agreed sadly.
You are correct. A friendly dog will always be played with.
You bet I am. People play with them and they pet them and they give them treats,
his cellmate responded irritably.
They say things like, good boy, that's the old fella with a cute little dog.
He gave Radu an accusing look.
Does anybody think a werewolf's cute?
He demanded.
Well, do they?
Radu looked down at his boots for a few moments.
I cannot say that they do,
he replied somberly.
It is quite wrong of them.
That's right. They don't think you're cute,
Lupin mumbled sorrowfully.
They don't want to play with you. They don't want to pet you. Or give you a treat,
he muttered.
I've never gotten one damn treat. They don't want to be your treat. They don't want that either.
It is most unfair,
Radu told him soothingly.
I'm certain you are a very handsome wolf, and I would give you a treat,
he added kindly.
I could drop it from the air in my bat form.
That is awfully good of you,
Lupin pronounced enthusiastically.
It is.
"You are the nice fellow I've ever known," he declared adamantly.
"I'm sorry to hear it," Roddy responded sardonically, "as I am not nice at all."
"Yes, yes you are," Lupin told him stubbornly. "If you hadn't fixed my shoulder, I would have bled to death. You could have flown upwards out of danger instead of going under Falling Rock," he added triumphantly. "But you didn't, because you were worried about me."
He nodded smugly.
"I was not the slightest bit concerned for you," Radu spat out angrily. "Apparently you have forgotten I just uttered a killing curse at you." "Sure you did," Lupin replied amiably. "Then you pointed your wand half an inch to the left of where you should have."
Radu leapt up from the couch and glared at him.
"What do you know of such matters?" he demanded spitefully. "Do not speak to me." "Okay," Lupin responded indifferently and yawned. "I want to sleep. I'm tired as all bloody fuck here."
He wandered back over to his scratchy couch and flung himself down upon it. And for a moment, Radu was so enraged he could not even speak. "He hears nothing for me," he thought furiously. "Nothing, nothing whatsoever." A sharp stab of pain welled up behind his eyes in the invisible space before tears.
"You will not sleep," he screamed. "I have not given you permission to sleep. It will be utterly tiresome for me to sit here while my only companion is asleep."
"Too bad for you," Lupin muttered rudely. "Had not to bother me. I haven't slept for more than 4 hours a night for a month. I've got a new baby, you know."
"Do not dare put that pillow over your head," Radu bellowed ominously. "I tell you, I will kill you."
Apparently, Lupin did dare, however, since the pillow stayed over his head, and Radu stood and stared at him in a sinister fashion.
"Sleep," he hissed in a serpentine tone. "Sleep. I shall do a night terror spell while you are sleeping," he announced exultantly. "You will dream of events more appalling and gruesome than you can possibly imagine." "Good luck with that,"
Lupin mumbled and fell asleep immediately. Radu's anger vanished instantly, replaced by bewilderment and a horrifying sense of vulnerability. He knew that he would not do the spell, and in fact, that he did not even want to do it. Here he is, at my mercy, and yet I do nothing. Where is the reason in this? When the answer came, he knew it had been hovering sightless around the perimeter of his subconscious for many weeks, and he was suffused with a wild elation and a violent black rage. "I should like to dismember the entire world," he thought furiously, but his anger kept slipping farther out of reach while the euphoria only intensified. And then I would dance in the wreckage. A sullen group gathered around the dining table at 5 till 6, casting impatient looks towards the doorway of the kitchen, which remained closed and silent.
"What the hell is our food?" Jamie barked out just as a surly Shalanda and 3 young girls with a grieved expression sauntered into the room and plopped 8 large platters defiantly onto the table.
"Here your food,"
Shalanda announced sourly and put her hands on her hips.
"And I don't get paid to run that kitchen. Lucretia gets paid to do that. I ain't running no kitchen by myself."
"What the fuck is this?" Jamie shouted as he glared at the platters, which were piled high with slices of burned toast, cold ham, mounds of greasy sausages, limp strands of green beans, and withered up stalks of bare celery. "We're not eating this shite."
"Then you better call a caterer,"
Shalanda responded insolently and turned her back on him.
"I done told you."
"Hey, super old dead dude,"
Kenny called out enthusiastically to Reginald, who was floating on his back about 10 feet above the table.
"Look down here, man! Check this out, dude! Look how much bigger it is, man!"
Reginald hovered politely above Kenny for a moment as he unzipped his filthy jeans and triumphantly yanked out his penis, and the entire table erupted into screams.
"Kenny!" Henry shouted and punched him in the side of the head. "There's little girls here, you stupid fuck!"
"I saw it!"
Natalie shrieked ecstatically and leapt up onto her chair.
"I saw it! I saw it! I saw it! I saw that old flat wiener! Did you see it, Elizabeth?"
"I saw it!"
Elizabeth wailed and burst into tears.
"I saw that nasty wiener and I never want to see it again!"
Kenny cackled madly and began racing around the table.
"Grab him!"
Jamie hollered, but no one seemed interested in making a lunge for Kenny while his dick was in his hand.
"What the hell is wrong with you, Kenny?"
"Man, I got some great shit today!"
Kenny screeched blissfully as he paused to wag his member in front of Parks' speechless and spluttering face.
"I'm so fucking stoned, dude! I am one stoned-ass motherfucker! I love my dick, man! I fucking love my dick! Ew!"
Rosie shrieked and flung a plate at his head.
Oh my god, this is the worst thing you've ever done, Kenny. Shut up, dude.
Kenny whined as he pulled up next to her proudly, preferring his prize.
You know you want it, man. Look how big it is, dude.
That's how big it is,
Rosie rejoined disgustedly.
It's just normal now, Kenny. Must have been so small, he felt sorry for you. He did not, man,
Kenny screamed angrily.
He didn't, dude. It is big, man. It's fucking huge.
McDonald, who was standing stiffly at the entrance to the dining hall, cleared his throat loudly.
Mr. and Mrs. Jones, sir,
he bellowed out.
And an Ermine Rivers,
he concluded disapprovingly. Who? Jamie said in a bewildered voice. An ancient, toothless man with a corncob pipe, stained straw hat, and tobacco-smeared trousers shuffled boldly into the room, closely followed by a skinny old black woman sporting a bright red polyester dress and a malevolent expression. After a moment, a tall, thin young man with a long brown ponytail and friendly countenance ambled past McDonald as well, gazing beatifically at the group through tiny, pink-tinted glasses.
Hey!
The man offered up in a frighteningly familiar voice.
Like, hey, there's a lot of you dudes here. Far out, man.
Fuck, Jamie blurted out with a panicked expression. Fuck.
I told you Carmine had a twin brother, Shella said crossly. I guess you never listened to me. And I asked you last week if he could come visit the kids. He's never met them.
Oh, yeah, right,
Jamie mumbled, but kept staring at Ermine, particularly his head.
Awesome, man,
Kenny chirped out merrily.
Awesome! You're like the same guy with his head back on, dude.
Ermine seemed a bit puzzled by this statement, but just nodded sadly.
Yeah, Carmine was one hip dude, man. He was a gas. It sucked when those drugs did him in.
His gaze wandered interestedly towards the quadruplets and lingered on Shala.
Wow! You're like, Shala? Rock on, he said enthusiastically. You are one foxy lady. You're a totally righteous babe. And look at those kids, man. There really are four of them.
Where be my room?
The old woman interrupted angrily.
Where be my maid? I is old.
Jamie ignored her and turned to Rosie.
Look at that dead-ass fucker, he hissed vehemently. Have you even got a job?
He yelled out rudely to Ermine.
Jamie! Shala said incredulously. It's none of your business.
Maybe it is, Jamie hollered back. I love those kids, and the last thing they need is some drugged-up loser of an uncle hanging around them.
I quit the drugs when Carmine died, man,
Ermine responded loftily.
I get high on life now. Life is like all around you, man,
he finished wisely.
Oh, who cares about that? We've been on an airplane all day, and we're hungry.
The old man bellowed furiously.
I ain't got no money. So I turn to my money here and how much do I get? $350. That's all I get.
We're cool, dude,
Ermine said soothingly as Jamie continued to glare in his direction.
I totally get your vibe, man. I'm like so with your vibe. You love the kids, man. I dig that. I so respect that. Love. That's right on.
Rosie noticed he still hadn't responded to the query about a job.
If you want me to blow the joint, I'll go, man,
he intoned sadly.
I just want peace and harmony. That's my daily bread, man. Peace and harmony. It's just a bummer.
He blew his nose loudly into a yellow gingham handkerchief.
It took me a couple years to get enough dough for that ticket from California, but I totally wanted to relate with my dead brother's kids, so I just kept on working those three jobs, man, just to see those little faces one time. But we're cool, man. I'll go.
What I say, Richard boomed out and shot Jamie a nasty look. It's quite all right, old bean. Why, I've a quarter ownership in this house, and I say you're welcome here.
Man, that's so awesome, Ermine told Richard earnestly. That's so, like, generous of you, Daddy-O. Sorry I look so gnarly, man.
He indicated his stained white t-shirt, threadbare jeans, and ragged leather sandals with a tragic expression.
Some psycho dude jumped me in New York and ripped off all my fancy threads, man. So I had to buy these at the airport gift shop.
Oh, please,
Rosie said loudly.
That's horrible, Shala told Ermine sympathetically, and he cast a smug look in Rosie's direction before slouching over to sit beside her.
Jamie cast both of them venomous looks before turning back to the elderly couple, apparently deciding they were both lost and demented.
You don't live here, he said kindly. McDonald will help you find your house.
No, sir. We grand live here,
the elderly woman replied stubbornly.
My name Ebony, and this my husband, Cotton. Lucretia done call us and say Mr. Quill tells her we can stay here and people going to take care of us.
You are related to Lucretia? Park sniffed disbelievingly.
All her life,
she replied rudely.
Lucretia mama, her name Mammy, was my oldest sister.
Lucretia always in our house when she a little giddy girl,
Cotton put in fondly.
Can't say she was ever little,
Ebony sniffed.
She fed like a pig when she's 6 years old.
She always wanted to be a cook,
Cotton continued as if Ebony had not spoken.
I remembered her running up to me with a big old smile in that little chef hat saying, Uncle Cotton, Uncle Cotton, and I said, what you need, Cretia? And she said, tree fitted.
Shalonda skulked back into the room and screeched to a halt, a panicked expression spreading across her face.
Lord have mercy,
she gasped and swayed alarmingly.
I now move all the way to London to get away from them.
Why? Jamie demanded. What's wrong with them?
They crazy, Mr. Quilla,
Shalonda wailed.
They crazy. They more crazy than Miss Elizabeth Baby Daddy to think he a wizard and blow things up all the time.
I cannot believe this, Lady Fanshawe screeched haughtily. Another drugged-up hippie and some elderly negroes from America living and dining with us. I'll be the laughingstock of the neighborhood.
Dad wouldn't ask anyone else to live here, Jamie said angrily.
The last thing we need is more people living here.
Well, he might have done, Rosie responded irritably, so he can make a new seating chart and have more people to boss around and make their lives miserable.
A depressed silence fell across the table, apparently indicating agreement with Rosie's statement. Lady Fanshawe, however, did not appear upset at all, since she usually ignored Rosie and hadn't heard a word she'd said. She began humming happily to herself as she snapped open her beaded silk reticule and withdrew a shiny pink object in earphones, placing these items beside her plate and gazing at them very fondly.
Is that an iPod, Grandmother?
Jamie snickered.
Yes, it certainly is, Caroline responded proudly. I have decided to change my age to 51. I am learning the music of my era.
Nobody's gonna believe you're 50, dude, Kenny told her knowingly. Not even a stoner, man.
That means you'd have had Elizabeth when you were 12, Jamie hollered in exasperation. How does that work out?
Elizabeth is no daughter of mine, Caroline declared haughtily, and your mother can keep her age to herself. I have decided my new boyfriend will be a middle-aged man this time. She glared horribly up at the deceased Reginald. What did I get out of having such an old boyfriend? She shrieked. A dead boyfriend, that's what I got. One who will not leave.
You didn't have much luck with that younger man thing before,
Rosie said spitefully, and Richard chuckled.
If you are speaking of that wizard person whose name I have forgotten, Lady Fanshawe intoned melodramatically, he's only 29 in Muggle years. He was too young for me. What I want is a middle-aged man, I tell you. Early 50s, I believe.
What the hell are Muggle years? Jamie snapped. Quit acting like you know all this wizard stuff, Grandmother.
Ha! I'm smarter than you think, Lady Fanshawe boomed out exultantly. Do the maths. And I would not speak about getting a man, missy, she added viciously to her granddaughter, since you cannot keep one, and your wizard boyfriend is in love with another woman.
Rosie leapt to her feet, trembling with rage, and blurted out the first thing that came to her head.
Grandmother's a werewolf,
she screamed at the top of her lungs, and the entire table erupted into howls of laughter.
Shleo-yap. Victor hissed threateningly. You don't supposed to say nothing.
This, of course, only led to further screams of laughter.
It's true, Rosie squealed furiously. Elizabeth knows it, and Mum knows it. They just promised her they wouldn't tell.
If Caroline knew that she was a werewolf, she made no appearance of it.
You have lost your mind, just like Loretta, she declared superciliously.
And I am learning all the songs my maid put on my iPod from the 60s and 70s, she trilled happily. I am certain they will help me attract my new middle-aged boyfriend.
That's out of sight, lady, Irmine told Caroline approvingly. 60 songs are the grooviest. And early 70s, man. I totally dig Elton John.
Those are just the songs I have memorized, Caroline shrieked excitedly and leapt to her feet.
"What the hell is she going to do?"
Jamie whispered to Rosie in a frightened voice, but Rosie, who had a good suspicion, was too horrified to respond.
"Don't go breaking my heart!" Caroline screamed dramatically. "I couldn't if I tried! Oh, honey, if I get restless!"
"Grandmother, stop!" Jamie shouted.
"Baby, you're not that kind!"
Loretta shrilled out delightedly.
I was ready that time!"
"Oh, nobody knows it!"
Lady Fanshawe wailed and clanked out an accompanying beat on her glass with a fork.
"Nobody knows! But when I was down, I was your clown!"
"I can't stand this!" Rosie squealed and gave Jamie a desperate look.
"Make her stop! What am I supposed to do?"
he said furiously.
"Beat her up? She's old! She's our grandmother!"
"Right from the start," Caroline continued happily, "I gave you my heart. Ooh, I gave you my heart."
There was a stunned silence at the table, which Caroline apparently took as an indication she was to continue singing.
"Someone saved my life tonight," she screeched passionately. "Sugar Bear.
You almost had your looks at me, didn't you, dear?"
Marlena screamed gleefully and clapped her hands.
"Oh, I love a sing-along.
You nearly had me roped and tied,"
Kenny yelled out happily.
"All to bow, hypnotize, sweet freedom whispered in me, yeah,"
Victor hollered drunkenly and stood up swaying. Even Loretta was shocked when Angel, apparently tired of her role as ever-sensible caregiver, suddenly bolted ecstatically to her feet.
"You're a butterfly," she shouted, "and butterflies are free to fly. Fly away!"
McDonald, apparently emboldened by her display, quite forgot himself as well.
"Hide away!"
he boomed in an impressive operatic baritone.
"Bye, bye!"
Ermine echoed blissfully.
"Man, I love how you dudes sing all the time. I'm totally down with that."
"Hush up, Craggle,"
Cotton told him irritably.
"Now, when we was on that plane, we was trying to eat, and all of a sudden, this great big creature come on down the aisle."
Everyone looked at Cotton with interested expressions, especially Richard, who loved a good story, and was pleased with the appearance of a man a dozen years his senior.
"It was a giant crustacean from the Paleolithic era,"
Cotton finished triumphantly and sat back in his chair.
"Good heavens," Richard snorted disgustedly, and Henry closed his eyes.
"I done told you,"
Shalonda wailed desperately.
"I done told you they crazy."
"We was eating taco salad,"
Ebony added with satisfaction.
"Doesn't matter what we were eating, woman,"
Uncle Cotton snapped.
"And anyways, I yelled out, 'What you want, monster?'"
"It was so scary,"
Ebony shivered dramatically.
"Yeah, it was scary, all right. It was a goddamn Loch Ness monster,"
Cotton hollered gleefully.
"And I says, 'What you want, monster?'"
"Oh my God," Jamie shouted furiously. "Nobody wants to hear this crap."
"Anyway, he says to me,"
Cotton continued undeterred,
I need about tree fitted."
"Tree fitted."
"Man, you dudes are crazy," Kenny informed Cotton matter-of-factly. "You're like totally out of your mind, man, and you aren't even stoned."
"Hey, we need peace here,"
Ermine told Kenny reprovingly.
"It's not cool to stick a label on a person, man. Nobody's crazy, dude. Different people have different feelings."
"Shut up,"
Rosie said crossly and stabbed at a piece of celery with her fork. Ermine shook his head reprovingly in her direction.
"I thought it was a radical story, man,"
he informed Cotton reassuringly.
"Yeah, it was out of sight and dynamite. We all loved it, my black brother."
Cotton gave Ermine a look of utter disdain and spat a long stream of tobacco juice on the polished hardwood floors.
"We need to sing again, yeah,"
Ermine informed the group decisively,
"so everybody can mellow out and get back in the groove."
"I am the one doing the singing," Lady Fanshawe hollered out indignantly, "and you are not here to give us instructions. Keep yourself quiet."
"Yeah, dude," Kenny piped up sullenly. "Listen to the old chick, man. You're already getting on our nerves, dude, and you've only been here 20 minutes.
Rosie snickered rudely at this, and her grandfather chuckled loudly. But Ermine just stood up and closed his eyes, swaying, and began reaching out his hands blindly in the air, as if he were Stevie Wonder.
"What the world needs now," is love, sweet love.
He cracked out in his horrendously off-key, high-pitched voice.
It's the only thing that there's just too little of. What the world needs now is love, sweet.
For God's sake, go get that damn chainsaw, Henry barked out to Jamie, and put it on the fucking floor. When's your dad coming back? Not soon enough, Jamie replied wearily.
Crystal ball,
Melvin hissed as he parted masses of dangling turquoise beads behind the round door in the back of the divination classroom. Tim, Alex, Melvin, Esther, Serena, and Dorcas hurried behind him, emerging into a cluttered room piled high with tarot cards, howling horoscopes, stacks of china teacups, and bags of beads, glitter, sequins, brightly colored yarn, and fringe, apparently for shawl-making purposes. Dorcas stopped and folded her arms in a threatening fashion.
"Has everyone memorized the directions?"
she demanded. No one had memorized the directions.
"Fine,"
she hissed angrily.
"Then I'll just have to tell you. Now, here's the crucifixes, and the Bible verse, and the bags of garlic, and the moon calf dung. And don't forget to walk around him 3 times.
"This is stupid," Alex mumbled sulkily, but jumped when incense slunk into the room and curled himself disdainfully on a turquoise silk-covered chair.
"Join hands,"
Dorcas shouted bossily, and the 6 formed a circle around the disinterested-looking feline. "This is the stupidest thing I've ever done," Tim thought sullenly, "and I've done a lot of stupid shit. I'm a fucking retard."
"Say it after me,"
Dorcas shrilled.
"Demon bound and demon sold. To the grave you'll flee. With this word and with these tools, we set your spirit free."
No one said it after her.
"Garlic!"
Dorcas shrieked.
"Mooncalf feces! Throw them!"
3 calcitrant group flung their baggies of ingredients onto incense, who merely yawned and gave them an irritated look.
"That cat isn't possessed," Alex said angrily. "There's not a thing wrong with that cat."
"I don't know,"
Esther piped in worriedly.
"Look at that!"
Incense had leapt off the chair and was standing on his hind legs, spitting and gyrating furiously.
"I don't think you should be doing that,"
Serena whispered frantically.
"I'm scared. He looks scary."
"Well, you look scary too if you're possessed by a demon,"
Dorcas responded unkindly.
"Now hold out your crucifixes and say the verse really loud."
This time, all 6 shouted the verse together, and the cat began retching violently.
"He's puking up that demon," Esther wailed. "I read about that in the Bible. Somebody puked up a whole bunch of demons."
"He's got more than one demon,"
Melvin said incredulously.
"Who knows?" Tim responded impatiently. "Anyway, what are we going to do with the one that he has?"
There was a long silence.
"Well,"
Dorcas sniffed haughtily,
"I didn't think about that."
"You didn't think about that," Alex yelled. "Some demon's getting out at us and nobody knows what to do."
"Well,"
Dorcas yelled back,
"why do I have to do everything?"
"Who's going to take on a demon?"
Melvin demanded.
"Who? Nobody, that's who."
"It's going to kill us all,"
Serena blubbered.
"We're all going to die. I've never even been kissed by a boy yet,"
she sobbed wretchedly.
"I'll kiss you,"
Alex said quickly. "You know, before we die." Serena bawled louder than ever. An hour of tense silence passed inside the Land Rover until Lucretia fell asleep and began snoring loudly, and Solange made an exasperated sound.
"I'm not listening to that all the way back to..."
Lucretia suddenly sat bolt upright and let out a piercing scream.
"Somebody done pinch my behind!"
she hollered.
"Kenny! Kenny, you in here?"
"Nobody pinched your own behind,"
Solange retorted irritably.
"You must have dreamt it."
"No, I didn't,"
Lucretia grumbled.
"I'm telling you."
She glanced down at the tote bags near her feet and spotted a small hand emerging from within the pile.
"Ah!"
she screeched at the top of her lungs, and Quentin slammed on the brakes.
"What are you doing?"
Solange squealed as he abruptly turned off the car and flung her the keys.
"Get out of this motherfucking car," he shouted and kicked the car door open. "I'd rather walk home than spend one more damn minute of my life with either of you."
"Day is a ham back here," Lucretia wailed unrepentantly. "A ham, Mr. Quilla. Oh, help me, Lord."
Quentin sprang out of the car with a disgusted expression, just as a shiny black head emerged from beneath the totes.
"I try to make big lady stop snoring," the Asian buggy driver announced sullenly. "That's why I pinch her. Not me for the screaming."
How in hell do people keep getting in my damn car? Quentin shouted, and Solange began giggling. This fucking door was locked!
Chinese people are very sneaky,
the man sniffed haughtily.
I did not know this. I see this car had tag from London. I need ride to London. I'm not able to make money in tourist town now with buggy smashed to pieces and all my horses.
His voices broke off and he ducked his head.
My horses! She had broken leg. I asked to shoot on horses. This terrible, terrible thing to happen.
He burst into tears, and 5 seconds later, so did Lucretia.
Oh, Lord, I'm so sorry,
she sobbed.
I'm so sorry. I don't kill your horses,
she blubbered.
I is bad. I be so mean and hateful to you and Miss Elijah. I'm so sorry. It's because I got that attitude. My mama told me I got that attitude, and she right. Oh, don't cry, Lucretia,
Solange said pleadingly and promptly began crying herself.
It was all my fault. I'm the one that ruined everything and kept complaining and acting like a spoiled brat. And I have ruined everything for everyone,
she screeched.
I'm the worstest person in the whole world, Lucretia bawled. My horses are dead,
the Asian man sobbed. Quentin looked hopefully at the highway for a speeding car he might fling himself beneath. But nothing appeared.
Stop all that crying, he demanded and frowned at Solange and Lucretia. Neither of you is a horrible person. You're just moody as hell.
He gave the Chinese fellow a surprisingly compassionate glance.
I'm very sorry about your horses, he said sincerely. Well, I don't know what to say. I'd do anything to help you.
I just need a ride to London, the man bawled and wiped his eyes. This is all I need. I try to start over in London, make a new life, have laundry service.
He finished gloomily.
Inside, all day.
What do you like to do? Quentin asked him kindly. If you could do anything you wished.
The man looked up and beamed at him.
I have gardens, he said ecstatically. That's my dream. Super beautiful flower garden. Bamboo bridge. Climbing roses. Mandarin ducks. Feng shui. Stone fountain. Flying peaches. 3 islands. Spiritual utopia.
He shrieked and clapped his hands 3 times in rapid succession. Well, at least he's enthusiastic, Quentin thought grudgingly. Albert's so damn doleful he looks like he'll start crying every time he trims a fucking bush.
Have you ever worked as a gardener? He inquired politely.
Oh, yes! I love gardens!
The man enthused and whipped out his wallet.
I'll show you pictures! This is my garden in my house! I study horticulture, study at university!
He nodded proudly.
Then, honorable father died and I had to quit university, take care of honorable mother and 15 brothers!
15 brothers?
Lucretia scowled suspiciously.
I never heard of nobody with 15 brothers, Mr. Quilla. And you knows we has big families.
My brothers never hear of you,
the man replied haughtily, and Solange giggled.
Well, I suppose you could give it a try,
Quentin offered up generously.
Oh, I thank you very much, Mr. Super Tall Rich Man!
The man screamed and leapt from the car, shaking Quentin's hand frantically.
I'd be best gardener you ever has! Best gardener! Most super fantastic gardener! You'll not regret it! You are best garden ever! Best garden in England! Best garden in world!
Excellent, Quentin said mildly. What's your name?
This I cannot tell, the man wailed in anguish. Tiny government not give me permission to leave country. I cannot use real name.
What? Quentin shouted. You're telling me I've just hired a fucking illegal alien?
I tell no one,
the man shrieked desperately.
I tell no one. I think of new name. Brand new name.
You ever see that movie, Sistine Candle?
Lucretia inquired sweetly.
I never see no movie, the man respired dourly. You think honorable mother bought popcorn for Sistine Son? We have no money for movie.
Then I say your new name be Long Duck Dong,
Lucretia pronounced gravely.
That a real good name.
Yes, so it is. I like the name,
the man enthused delightedly.
I be Long Duck Dong.
Quentin got back in the car shaking his head, and Solange began shrieking with laughter. She finally gasped out,
I shouldn't be laughing. I'm so sorry I ruined this trip for you, Quentin.
You haven't ruined it at all, Quentin replied cheerfully. I'd say it's been rather successful. We actually made it out of the country this time.
Solange leapt across the seat at him.
I love you,
she screeched and began bawling again.
Oh, Lord,
Lucretia blubbered from the back seat and honked her nose loudly into her handkerchief.
You two done made up. I've been praying and praying about this. Oh, thank you, Jesus.
Madge, blend of two peoples,
Long Duck Dong pronounced knowingly.
You make fresh thought.
Get back under those bags, Quentin barked, and he promptly dove beneath the totes. There's a fat, big-mouthed black cook and an illegal Asian named Long Duck Dong in the back of my fucking car, Quentin thought to himself, and this still might be the best day of my life. As the boys and Dorcas watched in fascinated horror, a gruesome apparition crawled from the mouth of the cat, enlarging itself as it came.
It's just like my stepdad said, Timothy blurted out exultantly. It looks like a person without any skin. That really is a demon. This is totally cool.
An unearthly wail resounded through the room as Sybil, rather frightening herself in a sheer pink nightie, rushed into the room and stumbled towards her cat.
Oh, incense! My poor baby! She shrieked and clutched the limp form to her chest. Oh, wake up! Wake up!
The demon began stalking the perimeter of the room, its red eyes gleaming, and stopped in front of Timothy with a ghastly grin.
Demons can't hurt you if you aren't afraid of them, Tim announced triumphantly. And I'm not afraid of you!
The demon spat angrily on the floor and slithered a few feet away.
Yeah, Alex said in a panicked voice. But I'm afraid of him, mate.
Me too,
Melvin rejoined.
I'm scared as crap. Not me,
Dorcas declared in a trembling voice. Esther and Serena did not respond, since they had their arms around one another and were crying, and the demon began making hissing noises from the corner.
Professor Trelawney? Alex demanded crossly. We've sort of got a problem here. Maybe you could help us out or something.
Sybil glanced up and recoiled at the sight of the demon, just as a loud cacophony of voices preceded the appearance of Professors Dragomir, Flitwick, Evans, Binns, Sinistra, and Weasley. All six of them stopped short and gave the demon a startled look.
Oh, professors!
Serena wailed frantically.
Please make that awful thing go away!
There's nothing I can do with the demon, Binns moaned. No, nothing. I'm already dead.
Really? Ron snapped sarcastically. Nobody ever noticed. We just thought you were so boring because you suck.
Three detentions, George!
Binns rasped out angrily and zoomed through the wall.
I'm not a student here, Ron hollered after him. I'm not George!
Dorcas gave him an irritated look.
Well, do something about the demon, she said authoritatively. You're in the order!
So's Flitwick, Ron mumbled. He just always forgets the meetings.
Demons! Can charm a demon?
Flitwick laughed nervously.
I teach charms. Can charm a demon? No, you can't.
I'm feeling poorly,
Professor Sinistra announced in a melancholy voice.
I believe I must have a lie down. Neptune is misaligned tonight.
She hurried out of the room.
Wait, yeah, I know, Ron said excitedly. I kind of know a priest. I mean, he isn't actually a priest, he said lamely, but he's in school to be one.
The other professors eyed him mistrustfully.
Well, at least help me summon him, Ron told them crossly. His name's William. He's Lupin's nephew, remember?
Flitwick nodded.
Short fellow, good at potions. Hang about with Fred.
Yeah. What's his last name? I can't remember it.
He glanced hopefully at Tim, who shrugged in return.
I don't know, he replied carelessly. Something stupid in German.
Can we please stay on the subject here?
Dorcas screamed.
Quiet! Dragomir roared. We shall simply concentrate on summoning Remus Lupin's nephew. Everyone, wands aloft! Nephew of Remus Lupin!
He bellowed commandingly. There was a loud bang, and Victor appeared in his filthy t-shirt, dirty jeans, and bare feet, with a sullen Kenny clinging to his arm.
You gotta help me find Lucretia, man!
Kenny whined.
You gotta... Hey! Where are we, man? Oh, this is just brilliant,
Tim shouted furiously.
That's bloody bang-up excellent. You just summoned a stupid old alcoholic, and he's dragged along the dumbest drugged-up muggle who ever lived. You're the worst professors in the whole world. I want to go to Durmstrang. I want to...
Quiet! Dragomir roared.
Tim's right, Ron intoned unhappily. That's exactly what they are. Harry hates that bald-headed guy.
What's happening here, mate?
Victor slurred out happily.
It's a party now, is it? Who's that bloody fella?
He said curiously as he glanced at the demon stalking wrathfully about the room.
Well, he looks like it's a dog's dinner, so he does. It's all skin back on, mate.
Victor whispered conspiratorially to the demon.
You're looking dead awful, is what I'm saying. Yeah, you look like shit, dude.
Kenny hollered out rudely.
You look totally terrible, man.
The demon screamed with rage and began hissing an extremely vulgar set of threats in the direction of the girls, who were all bawling loudly by now.
Man, you're making me sick, dude,
Kenny whined angrily.
That's some sick-ass shit to say in front of those girls, man. You're, like, totally inappropriate, dude. I think you're a fucking pervert, man.
The demon gave Kenny an incredulous look.
You're so gross, you're gonna make me puke, dude,
Kenny screamed.
I'm sick of shit now. I'm gonna barf my guts out all over this floor, man, and it's all your fucking fault, dude. I fucking hate you, man.
A huge thunderclap shook the castle, and the demon disappeared.
Bloody hell, Ron said in an impressed voice. That bald-headed muggle's so annoying he ran off a demon. Wait till I tell Harry.
I'm hungry, man,
Kenny told Ron peevishly.
Give me a sandwich, dude.
This is a piss-poor shindy, mate,
Victor slurred out and belched loudly.
What exactly having at large here? Was a buzz and a notch and a four whiskey.
It's not a party, you stupid git, Tim said impatiently. We came up here to get the demon out of Sybil's cat. And we did,
he added triumphantly. Sybil, who was stroking a purring incense in her arms, gazed at Timothy with a dreamy expression.
Oh, yes, yes, she choked out with misty eyes. Well done, my dear boy. Well done. 50 points for Gryffindor.
No problem, Tim replied cheerfully and grinned over at Dorcas. I'm the one that read the book twice, she spluttered furiously, and I tell them how to do it.
Of course, dear. Sybil murmured vaguely.
This will mean nothing, Dragomir bellowed, when the headmistress discovers 6 students have broken into a professor's quarters during the night.
The girls let out a collective gasp.
Oh no, Serena sobbed. This is worse than dying. My mom's going to be so mad at me.
We're going to get expelled, Esther wailed desperately. I don't want to get expelled. I'm going to throw myself off the North Tower. My brother will be really disappointed in me,
Dorcas shrieked unhappily,
and I'll never get to work in the ministry with him if I don't graduate.
The students did not break into my quarters, Claudio. I invited them here,
Sybil announced self-righteously.
I knew they were the only ones who could exorcise my cat. It was foretold,
she added melodramatically, and winked at the children.
Now, it is time for everyone to go to bed. Students, to your dorms. Claudio, please go on.
She hugged incense happily to her bosom and swished out the door.
I guess she told you, dude,
Kenny informed Dragomir spitefully.
Everybody's tired of hearing you yell, man. You're worse than Quentin, dude. He sucks my whole ass right down the toilet.
He glanced expectantly over at Tim.
You could kill him with that sectum sepra, dude,
he told Timothy knowingly.
Yeah, that ought to do it, man.
It's pretty smart, Kenny,
Tim replied kindly.
Except he's a vampire,
he added apologetically.
The only way you can kill them is to crush their brains.
Dragomir's face turned purple with some sort of apoplectic rage, and although his mouth kept opening, no words managed to come out.
That's disgusting, Dorcas shouted at Tim. It's so gross. Quit talking about crushing people's brains. He's a vampire, dude,
Kenny screamed and fell to the floor howling in terror.
Man, don't bite my neck, dude. Don't drink my blood!
Timothy shook his head in disgust at this great show of cowardice, and the 6 of them hurried out of the room. Dragomir hissed curses in several languages all the way to the defense classroom, where the door to his quarters hastily flung itself open for him before it could be kicked, cursed, or blown into pieces. He headed straight into the study, poured himself a decanter of goat's blood, and promptly began glaring at the various inscriptions on the charmed mirror. His eyes focused immediately on the inscription written by Lupin, and he began shouting at it as if he were yelling at the writer rather than his words. What Dragomir, along with most of his predecessors, did not know about the mirror, however, was that it was much more than just a historical message board.
"Why did you not leave me in the dungeons?" he bellowed at Lupin's handwriting. "I would rather be left alone in his dungeons than remain in this accursed country!"
There was a loud crack, and Dragomir disappeared. The cat, Artemis, who had been hiding behind the curtains, did not appear especially saddened by this as he wandered off to curl up by the fireplace. He was also not the slightest bit puzzled about it either, for Artemis was well aware that the mirror was also a wishing mirror.